Hello, and welcome to the Victorian Gas Lamp, the podcast shining a warm light on the 19th century, and most notably, throughout the reign of Her Majesty Queen Victoria. Episode 50, Victoria and Albert. Well, here we are, dear listeners. It has taken a while, and I thank you all for bearing with me through the breaks I need to write episodes, and yet you come back to continue listening. And we have made it to episode 50. And so, because it is the 50th episode, I thought it best to cover our patron figure of history, Her Majesty Queen Victoria. For those of you up to date on listening, I have previously covered the early years of Queen Victoria's life back in episode 39, The Duchess and the Princess. I ended that episode on her accession to the throne in 1837, which, as it turns out, works really well with minor overlap into her life as a married woman. She became Queen on the 20th of June 1837, but our story here begins in April of the year before. Victoria was celebrating her 17th birthday, and a young prince named Albert had been invited to the party. His uncle was Leopold I, King of the Belgians, and it was Leopold that introduced the two at Victoria's party. Cue that swelling musical score of an instantly in love couple. And now is the perfect time to give some background on the prince currently gazing into the eyes of the woman who would be his monarch as well as his wife. He had been born on the 26th of August in 1819, making him only a few months younger than Victoria, so he was actually 16 when he met her on this formal occasion. Albert was Prince of Saxe-Coburg-Saalfeld at the time of his birth, but by the time of their meeting at the party, his title had changed in 1826 to that of Prince of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. Regardless of the title change, the area he was born into is in what we would now call Germany. His father was Ernest, 1st Duke of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, and it was Ernest's younger brother Leopold, later 1st King of the Belgians, that was doing the introductions. They had never met before that birthday party, but were known to each other. Princess, later Queen Victoria, well, you might recall from episode 39 that her own mother was also a Victoria. She was Victoria of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, and the aforementioned Ernest was her brother. So yes, Victoria and Albert were first cousins. And another spot of trivia, they had both been delivered by the same midwife back on the day. Albert had an older brother, also an Ernest, so once again we are getting the same names everywhere, but he was very close to his brother when they were growing up. This was probably in some way a coping mechanism, as their parents' marriage was a chaotic one, with both of them enjoying other companions in, shall we say, the biblical sense. His mother, Princess Louise, went on to marry her lover after the divorce, but later died at only age 30 from cancer. His father remarried to Princess Marie of Württemberg, who was also his niece. I'm not making excuses, but it does bear keeping in mind that during this time, men married into their social class, and I guess after a few generations of that, anyone you marry is going to be related to you in some way. But still, Ernest is kind of icky. Anyway, educated firstly at home and then later at the University of Bonn, Albert studied law, philosophy, political economy, and art. He also did well in music, writing, and fencing. That kind of covers his backstory. After all, he's only 16 at this point and hasn't had much chance to gain a lot of backstory intrigue. But it was really the machinations of his uncle, King Leopold of the Belgians, that was trying to make this work. And while he was trying to make it so, King William IV, who at the moment is still on the throne in the United Kingdom, was preferring to have his heir apparent hitched to Prince Alexander, second son of the King of the Netherlands. So at this point, I feel the need to remind you, dear listeners, of the fact that not only did most royalty marry their relatives, that women were also basically pawns, regardless of their rank. King William clearly saw more advantage in closer ties with the Netherlands, what we would also call Holland, and was trying to cement this even further by marrying off his niece to that royal house. But being the proud dad of a girl about Victoria's age during this time, well, I can tell you, good luck with that, King William. Short version, Victoria thought Albert was crazy hot. Well, her words were that he had a beautiful nose, sweet mouth, fine teeth, charming countenance, all of which was, quote, delightful, and she thought Prince Alexander was, quote, very plain. Dude never had a chance. And Albert was clearly focused on Victoria as well. Their letters during this time discussed his education with a focus on the fact that he would need certain knowledge for his role as her consort. Now, I know that to us today, they were very young, but it does bear keeping in mind that people grew up a lot faster in the 19th century, especially when you were royalty. Yes, I know that they often acted in childish ways because of their privilege, but the responsible ones, such as Albert and Victoria, were well aware of the lives that they were expected to lead. They might have been what we would today call teenagers, but teenagers have only really existed as a demographic since after World War II. It's a marketing construct made to try and have a specific group of people buy particular types of products. Many of you listening now probably grew up before there was ever a mention of tweens. Well, it's the same thing. It's just advertising focused to sell. So being 16 going on 17, you were regarded as being an adult in many ways. And Victoria was well aware of the marriage machinations going on around her. But showing the strength of character that would define her reign, Princess Victoria had no intention of marrying anyone else other than the delightful prince. They kept in contact over the next couple of years, even through Victoria taking the throne in 1837, which changed things slightly. More on that in a moment. Because it was in October of 1839 that Albert returned to the United Kingdom to visit the now Queen Victoria, and they were going to settle what they both wanted, marriage time. And on the 15th of October, Queen Victoria proposed to Albert. And of course he said yes. That was the slight change I just alluded to. Because as Queen, Victoria had to propose, not Albert. With them now being engaged, it was formally announced in November, and they were married at the chapel at St. James Palace on the 10th of February, 1840. For the trivia, whenever you've seen that long boulevard shot leading up to Buckingham Palace, St. James's Palace is just off there to the right. And adding to that, Albert composed music for their wedding, which was met with critical praise for the quality of his work. I mean, really, could he endear himself any more? Great guy. As a couple, they started out their married life setting new traditions. Normally, royal weddings were conducted privately at night, but Queen Victoria was determined to share her special day. She invited more people than had ever been at a royal wedding, conducted it in the daytime, and set the standard for what we now experience with the public celebrations associated with a royal wedding. At the time, a woman's wedding dress was usually in a personally favourite colour, the idea being that that dress could then be worn on other occasions. But Victoria chose white. It made her stand out from the crowd for a start, but was also seen as a symbol of purity. And because white made it impractical for other use, it was a sign of wealth. Having a white wedding dress was not unknown, but it was rare. But because the Queen had worn white, it caught on in the eyes of the public, and it is a large part of the reason so many wear white to this day. Victoria's father had died when she was young, so she was given away by her favourite uncle. He's a man we've heard of before. It's Prince Augustus Frederick, the Duke of Sussex, which many of you know, I'm sure, is the title held by Prince Harry today. I did mention that they were totally into each other, and it turns out they really were a great match in the privacy of their palace. The Queen, a lifelong diary writer, wrote of her wedding night, quote, "I never, never spent such an evening. My dearest, dearest, dear Albert, his excessive love and affection gave me feelings of heavenly love and happiness I never could have hoped to have felt before." End quote. So yes, like I said, totally into each other. And possible apologies if you just had to explain that to your children listening. But even with this newfound publicity, as far as the public was concerned, well, they had some questions about the Queen's new husband. Despite the strong Germanic ties their royal families had, the English saw Albert as being a minor titled man from a small state and not really being good enough for their queen. There were concerns that he would use his position to influence politics in the United Kingdom. He also had family members that were Roman Catholics, and that was always questionable for people in charge in a democratic society. This caused ramifications for the Prime Minister, who was leading a minority government at the time. William Lamb, aka Lord Melbourne, was in charge and having to deal with this as best he could. And yes, the capital city of Melbourne in the state of Victoria, where I am right now, was named for him in 1837. Moving forward, it resulted in Albert only receiving a £30,000 annuity rather than the usual £50,000 and also denied him a peerage. Albert could care less, which props to him. As a Duke of Saxony, he felt himself above the local dukes and so was in the privileged world of royalty, comfortable being what he was. His title became His Royal Highness Prince Albert rather than Prince Consort, and it was only in 1857 that this was finally changed. Albert finally managed to get this changed through by the then Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston. Her argument was that having the husband of the Queen of England being given a proper English title would mean that he would be treated by other nations with the respect due to a noble of the United Kingdom. This, of course, worked. It needs to be remembered at this point just how important status was, not only of the individual, but also of the kingdom as a whole. Being confronted with the concept that the Queen's husband might be treated by other diplomats and royalty as being less than those that he was meeting was insufferable. So Albert got his title as Prince Consort, and Queen Victoria got her way, as she should. And now after moving forward, we're just going to move back. It was just easier to write it all that way, so indulge me in that. It is the 50th. In the earliest years of their marriage, Albert found it hard to find his place. He was a man with his own ideas and motivations, all of which naturally fell subservient to the Queen. He was not master of his house, Her Majesty was. Even in more domestic household matters, these were administrated by Baroness Leeson, Queen Victoria's former governess, and the woman that, in episode 39, quite possibly changed the world in defending and supporting the then future Queen Victoria against her mother. This was a society that was absolutely structured towards the man being the focus of a house, the one who provided and controlled the daily life of a household. This was the case whether you were rich or poor. And as I said, the public really weren't too sure about Albert either. This was 1840, and the last queen in her own right was Queen Anne. She'd died back in 1714, over a century ago. And she had married before ascending the throne. For the trivia, Queen Anne took the throne upon the death of William III, and Queen Victoria took over from William IV. which means I'm slightly worried about what might happen next today. Anyway, and if that wasn't far enough in the past, the previous queen to Anne had been Elizabeth I, and she'd died back in 1603, and famously had never married. The last time a reigning queen married was when Queen Mary married in 1554. So the population of the kingdom did not really have a lot of experience in having a queen and them getting married during their reign. But while Albert might have had concerns about his public position and what he should do with his days, he clearly had the knights sorted out, because within 2 months of marriage, Victoria was pregnant. Now, I've already mentioned what Victoria thought of Albert, and clearly the attraction was reciprocated. It is part of the reason that there have been any number of TV shows, movies, and other media devoted to their love for each other. We all love a good love story, but among royalty that's a rare thing when many marriages occur for the expediency of national interests and what could be called, air quote here, the greater good of society in general. For all their wealth, royalty are expected to marry for purpose, not love. So when it does happen, it makes for great public interest. King George III was known as being devoted to his wife and never had a mistress, a fact that was not lost on how the public saw him, and it made for a lot of news during his reign. His son was a party animal that I've spoken about before, and then William IV married to have legitimate children. So even in the current life cycle of the short-lived public, it had been over 20 years since someone had been on the throne that loved their spouse. And for Victoria and Albert, as far as the public was concerned, their love was obvious when only months after being married, in June of 1840, Edward Oxford tried to assassinate Queen Victoria. Details of that for another time, but for now suffice to say his attempt to shoot Her Majesty in her open carriage was unsuccessful. And while it might have been best in terms of personal safety to return to the palace, Victoria and Albert continued on their journey. Albert was later praised for his calmness during this event, and I'd like to think he was there for his wife when she needed him. I also have a great belief in Her Majesty's backbone, just for the record. Because the two of them continuing their journey publicly unperturbed turned into an absolute triumph of PR. Later returning to the palace after their trip, crowds were cheering them. Their appearances together over the next few days cemented the couple as just that, man and wife together, and even a later designated insane attacker could not separate them. Albert started to really hit his stride at this time. While Queen Victoria was going through her first pregnancy and ruling a huge part of the world, Albert became president of the Society for the Extinction of Slavery. By this time, slavery had been illegal for United Kingdom citizens for decades. The Anti-Slavery Act that completed this throughout the empire had been instituted in 1833, but the kingdom was striving for slavery to be banned everywhere. Beginning to impress the British public, opinion changed about this minor noble who had married their queen. An excellent example of this is how Parliament in that same year of 1840 designated that Albert could be regent for the as yet unborn child that the queen was carrying. I know this might sound kind of morbid, but it does bear keeping in mind that death during childbirth was still a real concern. In the early 1700s, it was 10 women in 1,000. 100 years later, and by the time of Queen Victoria, it was half this, being 5 in 1,000. But that's still a large figure, and we're talking about the Queen of the Realm and the future stability of the British Empire. So a lot rests on ensuring that there is a smooth transition of such immense power. Making Albert regent, if this was to occur, was a clear statement that he was seen as a genuine figure of power and responsibility within the ruling class of the United Kingdom. And to save you looking it up, let me point out that in the modern era, the mortality rate for mothers now in childbirth is 0.1 in 1,000. You're welcome. Also, you're as dark as me and definitely my people. While the couple were sometimes criticized for being strict followers of protocol in public, it's reported that their relationship outside of the public eye was far more relaxed and warm. And together, in November of 1840, they welcomed their first child. Sticking with royal originality, they named her Victoria. Baby Victoria will go on to marry the German Emperor Frederick III, and her son will be Wilhelm II. Wilhelm will be the first grandchild of Queen Victoria, and he's the emperor that led Germany into World War I. Again, another podcast. Over the next 17 years, the royal couple would have 9 children, all of whom made it to adulthood. No mean feat, even with all their privilege. 7 of these were born within a 10-year period. It's reported that during these times of pregnancy, the couple would have difficulties. I don't think we need to read too much into that, though. Albert would try to take over some of the royal duties to help his wife, and Victoria, well aware of her role and responsibilities, wasn't always happy with this. Additionally, she suffered from postnatal depression, and this made times difficult for her as well. But they did stay together and continue loving each other as much as ever. I'd like to think that the intelligent Albert clearly understood the incredible achievement his wife performed 9 times and supported her as best he could. Throughout it all, Albert, with less responsibilities than his wife, spent a lot of his time committed to the education of his family. The future Edward VII, born after Princess Victoria in 1841, was caned by his father because he was lazy in his lessons. I'm not excusing it, but this was considered standard punishment in this era, so again, don't read too much into it. By all historical reports and biographies, there was great affection between the two, and Albert was known by his children as being someone who loved them and enjoyed their company. The love between Victoria and Albert continued. Albert was someone that Victoria relied upon for his opinions and ideas. He was an educated man with a university education after all, and the couple moved their working desks side by side so that they could work together. Aside from his care for the children and his work with the Queen, Albert kept himself busy in other ways. In Aberdeenshire in Scotland, he bought a property and, in conjunction with an architect, expanded it to the needed size. This property is now Balmoral Castle, which any followers of the royal family know, that's the summer residence of the royal family. It's where Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II passed away in 2022. For all the work they had to do as a royal couple, I do find it interesting in everything I read for this episode that they were very family orientated. While Albert certainly took on more of the children's education, the couple made sure to spend time with their children. And one such aspect of this was part of another modern tradition that we have thanks to them. Influenced by his growing up in what is now Germany, in 1848 Albert arranged for decorated pine trees to be sent to the nearby army barracks and schools. That year, an image of the royal couple and their children decorating a Christmas tree was released. I'll post that on the Instagram account for you all to see. And reportedly, the royal family would have a tree brought in on Christmas Eve, which they would decorate with gingerbread, and the children would all be there too. And this is the beginning of the tradition that we have of Christmas trees. Their marriage continued to be a strong one between two people that loved each other right through to 1861. By then, Albert was having health problems with a recurring stomach complaint. In March of that year, the Queen's mother, the Duchess Victoria, died, and it was only in her mother's diary that she found out just how much her mother had loved her. Back in episode 39, I spoke about Lord Conroy and Baroness Leeson and their working for the Duchess. Now, reading the papers, Queen Victoria blamed these two for the estrangement that had occurred between her and her mother. The Queen was despondent during this time, and despite his continued ill health, Albert took over many of the required royal duties. This was the case in 1861, and in November of that year, Albert could be found visiting his son, Albert Edward, later Edward VII, in Cambridge. For over a month, scandal threatened to undermine the royal family, as reportedly the Prince of Wales had been spending his free time with an actress. I think I've mentioned this before, but the social status of an actress was around about the same as a prostitute during this era. So having a member of the royal family consorting with an actress was tantamount to disaster. By December, Albert had contracted typhoid fever. Victoria believed his continued ill health was linked to his stress over this social faux pas of their son. And on the 14th of December, 1861, Albert died. He had been married to the Queen for 21 years. Victoria was devastated. She had lost the love of her life. And for the next 40 years, until her death in 1901, the Queen wore black. And I think part of the modern romantic ideal of the royal couple is related to this fact. Sure, they might have had disagreements, as any married couple does, but they also had 9 children, spent time with them despite their incredibly busy schedules, and created traditions that exist for marrying, families, and Christmas to this day. Much of Victoria's widow years were spent at Balmoral Castle, and I'd like to think that she received some solace being in the home her husband had built for her. They were an amazing couple that saw the transition of their kingdom into the industrial age. Like her grandfather, George III, and his marriage to Queen Charlotte, Victoria and Albert became an idealized marriage in the eyes of the public. There was no scandal or gossip associated with them. Having loved each other since they were teenagers and created a family that would influence all of Europe in the decades to come. But again, this is me thinking, given what I've read of them, I think they would have been happy together regardless of their positions. Yeah, I'm a sucker for a good love story. Sue me. And here endeth the episode. You can find me at victoriangaslamp.com. My contact details are on there as well. And you can follow me on Twitter at @VicGaslamp. And more importantly, on Instagram, where I post historical facts and trivia as well as photos related to the episodes. I am at @VictorianGaslamp, or one word, there as well. Thanks for listening, and keep a lookout for new episodes. And as always, I'll see you next time under the gas lamp.